So Barbara Ehrenreich died in September 2022 and had a variety, had a long career of journalism and writing and political involvement. What I thought was always really peculiar about her is that, you know, most of her academic degree, she did get a PhD, but, you know, it wasn't in any kind of social science or humanities area. She was actually a biologist,
right?
And all things. And so she was also a Reedy. So I'm sort of, she was a fellow alum of Reed College. A couple of things, you know, I'll throw this out and then we can sort of talk a little bit about some of her work. I think I first came to be aware of her when I read Nickel and Dimed in 2001, which was her report of her experiment that she tried at the time to live a year purely on the earnings from minimum wage jobs. So I think that she posed as an investigative journalist, posing as a waitress, a hotel worker, a Walmart associate. And what she tried to do was not rely on any of her own sort of middle class access to credit and money, but just simply on the earnings from her her jobs to see if she was able to make it just on minimum wage at the time. And, you know, no surprise, it turned out that she was not able to do that. She had to, I think her conclusion was that to survive at the time, you would need at least two minimum wage jobs to work. But for me, the reporting that she did about that was just so vivid about the alienation and the drudgery of so much service work in the United States, which is, you know, one of the largest sectors of service and hospitality work in the United States. It's such a big part of the U.S. economy. And, you know, the thing that struck with me from that book was the chapter in which she's talking about her time as a Walmart associate.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a scene which I used for a while whenever I would teach Marx's essay on alienation to my undergraduates, right? Marx says that under capitalist societies, workers face a certain kind of alienation from one another, that they see each other not as fellow human beings or with any kind of class consciousness, but as competitors, as threats to their well-being. And that the scene in which she is having to fold shirts in Walmart, yeah. And put them away. And she has all these other people coming and telling her not to do it that way or to do it in a different way. And she's trying to figure out, like, wait, who are you? I've never seen you before. I don't know who you are. And why do you all of a sudden have the ability to tell me what to do on my job? But it was just sort of this thing where she admits that she just got angry at this other woman who started to boss her around. And she was just like, who are you to tell me what to do? And it took her a while to sort of step back and realize that both of them were stuck in these really alienating jobs. And that one of the ways that they were dealing with it was taking it out on each other. And she realized that that was a really sort of dangerous kind of spiral for a lot of minimum wage workers stuck in these jobs. It's just the sort of drudgery creates this alienation and anger and lashing out at one another. And her descriptions of that stuff was just so vivid that whenever I wanted to illustrate the sort of abstract ideas that Marx was talking about, I'd have folks read a chapter out of Nickel and Dimed.
Yeah, that's an important book. And she wasn't slumming. She herself grew up in a working class family in Butte, Montana. Her father was a copper miner. So she was really familiar with those kinds of jobs. She'd held them herself. And then when she achieved some kind of financial stability and went to Reed and became, you know, moved into the middle class, what she calls the middle class. I think one of the things she wants to make us really aware of in this book is that wealth is not innocent. And that because of living in a class structure, you're always going to be confronted, if your eyes are open to it, with this moral conundrum, because in a class structure, the well-being of some is built on the suffering of others. And there's hardly no way to escape that conundrum without transforming the system itself and addressing those injustices and inequalities. And I think that's what she's partly been trying to do through all her works. But I think especially Nickel and Dimed, especially the ending of Nickel and Dimed, where she talks about how in the middle class, the sense of well-being people have, people don't realize how much of that well-being is based on the suffering of the classes that don't have those same kinds of securities, right? But then she also wrote a book about the fear of falling, which is the fear of falling from the middle class, and how there's a lot of anxiety and fear in the middle class too, about losing that position, how it's always a real basic fear and insecurity and anxiety underlying your well-being, given the structure that we live in, right?
Yeah, that was the other sort of book that was really, you know, impactful too. This came out, I think, in 19... I'm now blanking on the year about this, but this, I believe this was Brightsided. The book that came out afterwards, where she did a similar kind of investigation, by looking at, sort of evangelical Christian and, the culture of, entrepreneurial success. These different kinds of workshops that were being sort of created for managerial middle-class people and for evangelical Christians at the time, that with, along with the gospel of prosperity, where there was a sort of, emphasis on thinking about one's abilities to succeed in the world as just a matter of, pushing ahead, having the right attitude. If you have the right attitude, you can succeed, and failure is a matter of not, you know, if you're a Christian, of not having enough faith, or if you're sort of just a secular middle-class worker, of not having enough confidence in your abilities, right? And so it's just a matter of developing that kind of like Tony Robbins, right? The right sort of attitude. Yeah. And there was a whole industry of these confidence-building seminars that workers could go to. And, you know, if you were an evangelical Christian, you can go to those huge mega churches. But the message was very similar, is like, if you think optimistically, good things will happen to you. But failure is an individualistic kind of feature of the world. The world is really mostly fair. And so that was a really insidious work, because it really showed the kind of ideology that covers over all the systematic ways in which people get disenfranchised. People remain poor, not because they're lazy or not entrepreneurial enough, but because there are huge structures standing in the way, or huge barriers. But for middle-class people, that anxiety of falling can be assuaged with these prosperity gospels that I think have contributed in some sense to, you know, the kind of hustle culture that still exists for young people today, right? Of just sort of like thinking about the right ways to become entrepreneurial and always having to work hard for yourself. You see a lot of that still on social media directed towards young people, that it's just, you know, a certain kind of way of positioning yourself and success is guaranteed to you. And so I think that that book, that sort of analysis of hers, was really capturing something unique too that goes on in American culture, which is the sort of prosperity culture, gospel culture, or the entrepreneurial hustle culture, which is still very strong.
Right, right. And I want to also pay tribute to her early work, her feminist work, especially around women and healing. Was it called Witches, Nurses, and Midwives? I probably got that backwards, but that was a really early work with Deirdre English. And then she also wrote a book on, the subtitle was something like 200 years worth of experts' advice to women. and this was early, this was again, 70s, 80s. So really setting a kind of foundation for a class conscious feminism.
Yeah, I think I think the book that the title you were looking at is Witches, Midwives, and Nurses, A History of Women Healers, with Deirdre English, 1972.
Yeah, early, yeah.
Yeah. And then the other one was For Her Own Good, Two Centuries of Experts' Advice to Women, 1978.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one that I think that, the connection that you were thinking about too, to Davis was, you mentioned this book to me before too, which is Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy.
Yeah.
Right. The ways in which, again, this is one of those things of like looking at the usable past for ways in which, how have, you know, communities come together to express solidarity and joy with one another when, you know, we've been talking so much in American sociology for the past 30 years about bowling alone and the kind of alienation that we live. Right. So, again, this was one of those things where I think that, you know, she knows the alienation that a lot of American workers face and the loneliness, which contributes to so much sickness, so much drug abuse and suicide. So that work, I think, was really interesting in terms of trying to figure out, like, how do we figure out ways to express joy with one another in solidarity and not just simply consumerist pleasures?
Right, right.
And that's a connection, I think, with, you know, as you were saying, with Mike Davis in terms of thinking about this kind of way of thinking about collective happiness as opposed to consumer pleasure.
And how a lot of the opportunities for collective happiness arise out of movements of mm-hmm. different kinds.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, and, you know, just to sort of start wrapping up about Ehrenreich's work, we've talked about this before in other contexts, but one of the things was, you know, not only her sort of investigative journalism about the alienation of the working class, but some of her early work that I know that you appreciate about the professional managerial class, right, from the 1970s and 80s that I think, you know, is such a unique contribution to thinking about class analysis in the United States that I wish there was more sort of discussion about this in the kinds of leftist works that I see when we're talking about how to think about the world today, because we so much focus on questions about like the working class and the owner class or the bourgeoisie. And her contribution is to really understand that there's more layers in between there. One of them being this professional managerial class that's really important to think about in terms of how class power works in the United States.
Yeah, the PMC, so-called, right? She wrote this essay with the person who was her then partner, John Ehrenreich, called The Professional Managerial Class. And it came out in the early 70s in Radical America, which was a journal that a lot of people in the movement were reading at the time. A great journal, actually. And in the PMC, she wants to ask people who think of themselves as middle class or professionals, who they're really serving and who they really want to, what kind of society they want to envision working toward. And how do you do that from your class position, right? And so she makes an argument that there's this sort of intermediate class between the working class and the ruling elite, which is the professional managerial class. We're the buffer zone, she says, you know, those of us who think of ourselves as professionals, you know, who are degreed, so on and so forth. But a lot of our work is about controlling, analyzing, not necessarily making life better for people in the working class, right? And doing all this, including our research on behalf of the concerns of the ruling elites who get to set the agenda. So it's a challenge in the early 1970s. So think about that time. It was a time kind of toward the end of the long 60s, as people call it, right? Where there was still revolutionary hopes, right? And so people in all walks of life were thinking about a huge, deep transformation of the society. And how can I contribute to that with others, right, from my position in the society? So this was addressed, it was a strategic piece addressed directly to people who consider themselves middle class or professional, right? And asking basically that question, which side are you on?
And what's amazing about that piece, I think, to think about now is, I mean, in some sense, it's sort of prophetic about thinking about the kind of analysis that Occupy had about the economy, right? That, you know, the drivers of the economy in a certain kind of way, in terms of thinking about who controls it, is the 1%, right? Instead of trying to think about like sort of working class, middle class elites, we need to understand that, you know, there's this professional middle class in between all of this, which is what most people aspire to sort of get into, right? You know, so much of academia and the work that, you know, we've done over the past couple of decades together, is most students, when they aspire to think about making it or becoming professionals, are thinking about fitting into a slot somewhere in the PMC. But the reality, right, is that she's pointing out is that they're not the drivers of the capitalist economy. It's the elite, the 1%. I think that her intervention in thinking about the PMC like that was really important in sort of trying to get us to rethink how power works in capitalist societies, that I think really started to come together, you know, what, say, some 40 years later with Occupy and that kind of analysis. So I think that that was really important. And it's one of these things I think about still today when I see sort of all these debates amongst leftists between Marxist-Leninists and various other folks, that this kind of reality of the PMC is never talked about very much. It's usually just like, oh, you know, the working class versus the capitalist elite. But we need to understand that of the importance and the power of that layer to, as you were saying, sort of manage the conflicts of capitalism, right? It, you know, it's interesting. The PMC is a sort of like the HR of capitalist societies. They are trying to enforce the rules and smooth things over to keep, you know, the system working, but they're not the power decision makers.
Right. So she asked this basic question, what do you want? How do you serve the system as it is? How do you want it to change? And if you want it to change, who are your allies? Who should you be making common cause with, right? Which is really important. That, I mean, as a piece of sociology, of course, you can endlessly debate whether or not the PMC can really be considered a class unto itself, or whether it's another segment of the working class, which is stratified, right? And in fact, after they came out with that essay, The Professional Managerial Class, in Radical America, South End Press put out a whole book of responses to them, which includes the original essay called Between Capital and Labor. But asking that strategic question, how can you be a part of a change that benefits all? And who are your allies in that? What can you do from where you, whatever your position is?